This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is another story about the legacy of the Cold War, a story about American arms that were sent to fight the Soviets but are now out of our control. After the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, we helped arm the members of the Islamic resistance known as the Mujahideen. The Soviets pulled out of Afghanistan in 1989. Last year, the Afghani communists were forced out, leaving opposition groups feuding over power. Well, who has the American arms? And are the former Mujahideen now training Islamic militants from other countries? My guest Barney Rubin is an expert on Afghanistan. He directs the Center for the Study of Central Asia at Columbia University. I asked him what kind of arms the U.S. sent the Mujahideen during the war.
We supplied them with a vast array of weapons ranging from Kalashnikov rifles, which are the basic assault rifle of the Soviet Army, all the way up to Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, which are laser-guided, shoulder-held missiles which had previously not been distributed anywhere outside of NATO. In between, we supplied them with various surface-to-surface missiles, anti-tank rockets, and other sorts of heavy weapons.
What are those weapons being used for now?
Now, first of all, they're being hoarded by various holders of power in different regions of the country for various local contests. Second, they're being used in an ongoing battle for the capital city in Kabul between two different Islamic parties and leaders. And third, they're being used from time to time in various battles in different parts of the country. I should add, of course, that besides the weapons supplied by the United States, there was an even larger amount of weapons supplied by the Soviet Union to the Afghan army. That army has now largely broken up, and those weapons are also in a variety of hands.
So do you think that the United States and the Soviet Union, in their Cold War dispute, helped to unstabilize the area?
Absolutely. Of course, they don't hold the responsibility for the breakout of conflict in Afghanistan, but the introduction into that area of an immense number of sophisticated heavy weapons has made that conflict virtually insoluble now.
Some people have made a connection between the World Trade Center bombing and America's support of the Mujahideen during the war in Afghanistan, because some of the suspects in the bombing have been connected to the Mujahideen. What do you know about those connections? Can you go over some of the particular people and what their connections were?
I don't know these individuals, of course, but in the course of the war, an estimated 6,000 people came from various Arab countries in order to fight alongside the Mujahideen. It became an important cause for them in the same way that the civil war in Spain became a cause for the international left. It was also a place where they could obtain military training from sympathetic people. Very usually, they aligned themselves with the more extremist groups of the Afghan resistance, mainly the Islamic Party of Gulbuddin Hikmatyar and a party that had very strong support from Saudi Arabia, led by a man named Sayaf. The party of Hikmatyar in particular was also the one that received the largest share of the aid provided by the United States, because the CIA and the Pakistani intelligence agency with which it worked argued that it was militarily most effective and argued that military effectiveness should be the main criterion for distributing the aid, not whether a party was more compatible with our ideas. Of course, that's a very common argument for the CIA, taking a so-called hard-nosed view in foreign policy, that one should support the toughest guys possible against communism or whatever else we are fighting for, because they will be most effective. That helped to create some of the infrastructure, which I'm sure was later used for training and hosting, if not these individuals, then many people like them. And from what I've seen, at least two of the individuals involved in the World Trade Center bombing, or at least I should say accused of involvement in that bombing, were connected while they were in Afghanistan with Hikmatyar's party. That's just a way of illustrating what I think is true generally, that in supporting groups whose views are antithetical to those of our own, especially since in Afghanistan we didn't have to do so, there were many other groups who were ready and willing to fight the Soviets, we are not really taking a hard-nosed position in favor of our interests. We are really ultimately undermining our own interests.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The person who you just referred to, the head of the radical Islamic group, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar.
Yes.
Isn't he now the prime minister of Afghanistan?
Yes, he is the prime minister of Afghanistan, in the sense that a group of leaders have agreed to grant him that title, and he has named a number of other people to positions in his cabinet, but he doesn't exercise any of the functions which would normally be associated with being a prime minister, such as governing the country. What he's mainly involved in doing is waging a war against the president and defense minister of Afghanistan, who control the capital and won't let him enter the city.
I've read that Mahmoud Abulalima, who is one of the suspects in the World Trade Center bombing, is said to have gone to Afghanistan during the war to fight with the rebels, and that Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, at whose mosque several of the suspects belonged, that he was said to have spent time in Pakistan, the rebel base, during the war in Afghanistan. What do you know about that?
I don't know anything about the former person, but of course, Sheikh Abdullah Omar was well known, and he did travel there and gave his support to some of the groups who were fighting against the Russians. I would say that's not something I would hold against him. Of course, that was a cause which was supported by the vast majority of countries in the world, as shown by the majorities in the General Assembly against Soviet presence there. I also don't think it means that they received direct support from the United States. They had their own sources of funds, and they had their own interest. But it does show that we supported certain groups there, which were the particular groups that they also affiliated themselves with. Now, at the same time, it's important to point out there were other groups we were also supporting, although to a lesser extent, that these people found to be anathema. They didn't consider them to be Islamic enough. They said they're nationalist, or they're Afghan nationalist, rather than Islamic in what they consider to be the proper way. These were groups that we could have given more support to.
Some people have said that the Sheikh was probably helped into the United States by the CIA as a thank you for his work against the Soviets. Do you think that that's likely?
No, I don't. First of all, the United States government never encouraged or supported these Arabs to come and fight in Afghanistan. We didn't need their support. There were plenty of Afghans who were ready to fight, and we had adequate sources of funding and so on our own. I think you could say there's an indirect connection in that he made use of some of the infrastructure for the war that was provided by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia through Pakistan to Gulbuddin Hikmatyar and some other leaders. But I very much doubt that the CIA had any direct operational connection with him or did any favors for him.
To what extent has Afghanistan become a training center for Islamic militants of other countries? And who's getting trained there now?
Well, there are two ways of answering that question. One, I could just answer it directly and say, yes, some militants, I don't know how many, maybe several thousand, mostly from Arab countries, are in fact getting trained there. But in a way, although that's true, I think it's misleading. Because what is happening today is that a number of governments in the Middle East who have extremely poor records of respecting the rights of their own citizens and of providing for their economic and social security are now confronted with opposition movements, which often take on an Islamic character. And they are trying to claim to the rest of the world that the source of these opposition movements is some kind of external subversion, either from Iran or from militants trained in Afghanistan. And that simply is not true. The source of these movements is the problems in their own societies. Of course, when they create a political situation where people are almost forced to turn to military means as the only available means of opposition, then those few people who have received military training, say in Afghanistan or elsewhere, will prove to be more useful. But, for instance, the Islamic militants who assassinated President Sadat in Egypt did not receive their military training in Afghanistan. They received their military training in the Egyptian army and elsewhere in Egypt, and that is still the dominant pattern.
My guest is Barney Rubin. He directs the Center for the Study of Central Asia at Columbia University. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barney Rubin, Associate Professor of Political Science at Columbia University. Is there any connection that you would make between what's happening in Afghanistan now and what's happening in the former Yugoslavia?
I would say, of course, there's no causal connection. If I were to find a comparison, actually, I think a better comparison would be Somalia rather than Yugoslavia. Again, in both of these countries, Somalia and Afghanistan, you had central governments that were basically propped up by foreign aid, especially weapons aid, which came as a result of the Cold War. With the end of the Cold War, that dictatorial regime broke down, but the legacy of internal conflict and foreign-supported dictatorship was that whatever weak political institutions had existed before had broken down, and the only sources of power you had in both countries were well-armed militias of various sort, which were in Somalia associated with clans, in Afghanistan with a somewhat more complex tribal and ethnic sort of mosaic. In both countries, you also have had pockets of hunger. It hasn't reached the Somalia-type proportions in Afghanistan yet because the country is situated at the center of some important trading networks. But certainly in the capital, there have been food shortages. And Kabul has been probably more devastated by fighting among these different militias than Mogadishu has been. It's just it's so dangerous to go there that we don't see it on our television screens.
Let's pull back a little bit and look at Afghanistan during the Cold War. The United States and the Soviets were backing different sides. What were the interests of the United States and the Soviet Union in Afghanistan?
For the Soviet Union, Afghanistan had a strategic value because it shared a very long border with it, and it also had maintained its neutrality despite the fact that all of the countries around it, Iran and Pakistan in particular, had joined in anti-Soviet pacts during the 1950s. It was a kind of showcase for Soviet ability to aid a non-communist government. In addition, of course, there are ethnic commonalities with people on both sides of the border. In North Afghanistan, there are large numbers of Tajiks and Uzbeks, the same people who live in the former Soviet republics of Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. For the United States, it was much less central, but it was a territory from which hostile forces could threaten Pakistan, which was one of our important allies in South Asia and also in the Middle East. And furthermore, we wanted to deny the Soviets the ability to advance toward, as we saw it, toward the warm waters of the Persian Gulf. So it was essentially a kind of Cold War strategic conflict in which each side wanted to deny the other control of a strategic territory.
There was the hopes for some kind of democracy in Afghanistan after the end of the war. What actually happened after the Soviets pulled out?
For some time after the Soviets pulled out, that is from February 1989, when the last of their troops left, to, say, the end of 1991, when the Soviet Union dissolved and the U.S. and Moscow agreed to stop giving any more military aid, a proxy war continued inside the country. But the fact is that with the withdrawal of the Soviet troops, it lost a lot of its ideological character. Many people didn't see it as a jihad against unbelievers anymore. And what really happened is the central government lost power. The exiled political leaders in Pakistan that we had been supporting, leaders of the Islamic parties, lost power. And independent power centers within Afghanistan became much more important, usually based on some kind of ethnic or tribal ties. The leaders of these groupings may have belonged to one of the Islamic parties. They may have fought as militias on behalf of the government. But in fact, the basis of their power was their ability to deliver goods to their local clientels. As long as the Soviet Union continued to give food, cash, and weapons to the central government, however, it was able to maintain its position in the capital, and by redistributing these things, like a kind of tribal leader, was able to maintain the loyalty of some key militias throughout the country. But as soon as the U.S. and the Soviet Union agreed to stop aid, that government basically lost the resources that had enabled it to stay in power. And within about 100 days from the time that the ending of aid took effect, the government basically crumpled from within. What then happened was that certain forces concentrated in North Afghanistan, which for various reasons had become better organized and were mainly Tajik and Uzbek, took over the capital and, together with some of the leaders from Pakistan, proclaimed an Islamic government. But that government has not exercise control over the territory of Afghanistan. So the situation since then has been one in which various militias, political parties, forces have exercised power in different parts of the country. Sometimes they have talked like they might separate from the country, but no one has really made a openly separatist move thus far. But in fact, the regional powers are autonomous of the central government, and all of them have some kind of international sponsors in the region.
Barney Rubin is my guest, the director of the study of Central Asia at Columbia University. We were talking about the role of the United States in Afghanistan and all the weapons that we sent the Islamic rebels. Do you think the United States should be doing anything for Afghanistan now that the country is still so unstable and still left with all the weapons that we sent?
Yes, I think that we do have a moral responsibility, and that Russia, though it's less able to bear it at the moment, also has a moral responsibility, Russia and its the other successor states of the Soviet Union. We took advantage of the willingness to fight of the people of Afghanistan to pursue our own political goals, and in so doing, we helped unintentionally, I'm sure, and not against the will of the people of Afghanistan, but we helped to destroy their country and land it in the position that it's in now. In addition, I think it's a very good case of a potential disaster that we can help to prevent. At the moment, the United States has basically abdicated any position with respect to a political settlement in Afghanistan. That means that the one group that remains interested in it in the world, which is the more radical groups of Islamic fundamentalists in the Middle East, has almost a monopoly on ties with the groups that we had formerly been supporting. I can't believe that that's a good thing. Any initiatives for a political settlement in Afghanistan are now entirely in the hands of the regional governments, who have many problems of their own, that is, the governments of Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Iran, and so on, who have many problems of their own and not very many resources. The United Nations is not involved, basically, because the permanent members of the Security Council have not given the United Nations a continuing mandate to be involved in a political settlement in Afghanistan. There's a proposal which has been floated recently, which I think the United States should get behind, and that is to form a grouping called Friends of Afghanistan, including all the major states that were involved in the war, the U.S., Russia, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, to try to empower the United Nations to find some kind of political settlement involving negotiations and move toward, if not elections, then some kind of a traditional assembly that can create a government with more legitimacy. Unfortunately, the appointments process in the new administration is taking so long that there isn't really anyone in a position of responsibility at the right level to whom one can address this. But I'm hopeful that soon the new Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East and South Asia will be in position. That's Ms. Rafel, who is currently in New Delhi, and she will be able to support such initiatives.
Are these exciting times for a scholar of Central Asia? There's so much action happening there now.
Yes. I, of course, first of all, my background was more in Afghanistan and the area to the south. Those people who specialized in Soviet Central Asia previously are now finding a whole new set of topics that they can investigate that they were really barred from doing before. For instance, people can now take public opinion surveys and travel somewhat more freely. And of course, there's a whole new set of political processes that are occurring. In fact, it's not just exciting for scholars of Central Asia, it's exciting for scholars of the Middle East and South Asia, because those whole areas are now being redefined. What has happened is not just the breakup of the Soviet Union, it's the breakup of the European colonial map of Asia. Because that's what the line between the Soviet Union and the countries to the south really was. It wasn't something invented by the Soviet Union. And this whole area is now being redefined. Essentially, 50 million people of Turkic language are now re-entering the Islamic world. Several million people of Persian language, that is Tajiks, are also re-entering it. That's going to change the balance of forces within the Islamic world, for instance, away from the Arab countries that have previously dominated it, more toward Turkic and Persian speakers, and restore a situation that existed before European colonialism. So I think that in thinking about these changes, we have to not just look at them in terms of what's going to happen in the next few months or years or even decades, but what might be happening over the next few centuries as Asia reorganizes itself.
Barney Rubin directs the Center for the Study of Central Asia at Columbia University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.